There was never any attempt to go up the chain and find like the big drug importer, which is something that I think people were surprised about, because I think most people think, well, the federal government, if they're going to get involved in drug cases, it's going to be after, you know, Pablo Escobar. But that's not actually the case. And, you know, I had the same experience representing people in mortgage fraud cases because, you know, they didn't prosecute any high-level bankers, but they went after people that filled out loan applications and were urged by the loan officer to, you know, to get the ratios right. And, you know, you got to say you earn this much money. And those are the people that were prosecuted and sent to prison.
Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Deep Focus. I talk a lot about my former career in the CIA and my post-CIA time at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but one story that people like to hear, because I think it's an important story, is about some work I did doing a study on the cultivation of heroin poppy in Afghanistan. Well, it's a long story. I'm not going to tell it. I'll keep it very short. The bottom line is that in 2001, before the 9/11 attacks, the United States not only provided the Taliban with tens of millions of dollars to fight the cultivation of heroin poppy. By the end of the year, Afghanistan had produced no heroin poppy, none. Well, by the end of 2002, Afghanistan was producing 93% of all the heroin poppy in the world. They did that under American leadership. Many of us believe that the so-called war on drugs was an abject failure, and not just because it only addressed the cultivation and the production of drugs. It was a failure because it did nothing to treat the root of the problem here at home. You know, instead of sending people to prison for these draconian lengths of time, we should have been offering them rehab and therapy. It's something that was never even considered on Capitol Hill. Well, our guest today is not just a prominent A-list attorney. He is a leading voice against the government's failure to do something about drugs from the user side. He's represented countless people who've been charged with drug crimes, many of whom have been charged using bogus evidence. And I know him as a great champion of civil rights and civil liberties. Len Goodman, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate you being here.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you inviting me. Yeah, and it's a topic I always like to talk about, and I was glad to hear or see you writing about it and speaking about this topic.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. And when you reached out to me, you and I have known each other for years, but when you reached out to me to talk about drugs rather than to talk about Guantanamo or some of the other issues that you and I normally talk about, I was intrigued because I didn't know that so many of your clients had been accused of drug crimes over the years. And I was very intrigued, especially intrigued when you said that many of them faced bogus charges using trumped up evidence. Now, that's always an assumption that I've made about prosecutors and police, but it was kind of vindicating to hear somebody like you say it. Can you tell us a little bit about that and about your background in representing people accused of drug crimes?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. Yeah, I began working as a criminal defense attorney in the early 90s, which was really the heyday of the war on drugs. And I worked mostly in federal court, not exclusively. My experience representing dozens of people charged with drugs, it's usually drug conspiracy in federal court, as you probably are aware. The feds love the conspiracy charge.
And the sentences are long with conspiracy charges.
Yes. And my experience really made me feel great contempt for the federal government. And I think maybe that's why you and I get along so well.
I suspect.
But, you know, like most federal policies that include the word war, there's a great deal of fraud in there. And whatever the problem that the war is targeting is going to be made worse by the federal policy, and many lives will be destroyed. The war on drugs is a classic example. The origin of the war on drugs, or at least this current version of it, dates back to the 1980s, and it's pure politics. You know, back then there was crack cocaine was all in the news, crack babies, crack flooding cities. Now, of course, as you would know way better than myself, there's questions about the CIA's involvement. Gary Webb did a whole piece about that. I'm not going to speak about that because I have no expertise. The other thing that happened in the 80s, which was significant, was the death of the Boston Celtics number one draft pick.
Len Bias.
Len Bias. And that was all over the news. So it was sort of like a perfect storm. And, you know, Congress rushed to pass, you know, to do something. And of course, all they know how to do is punish people. Who are they going to punish? Basically, black and brown people. And they rushed through a couple crime bills in the 80s. And basically, the main features of these bills were, as you mentioned already, mandatory minimum. So sentences. So basically, they focused on crack cocaine, but also powder cocaine and heroin and marijuana. We could talk about that a little bit, too, because now there's some good news, slightly good news on the marijuana front. But basically, if you had a crack cocaine, or if somebody said you had it, you didn't even have to have
it. Right.
If somebody said you had it and it was about the size of a golf ball, that's about that's 10 grams approximately, that was worth 10 years in prison, mandatory. And then if you had a prior, which a lot of people did, a prior felony, it's 20 years. So that was mandatory minimums. They abolished parole. So you had to do 85% of your time. And they passed these conspiracy laws, which basically allowed them to scoop up a whole group of people and say that they're all working together and make them testify against each other. And then the other thing that was significant in these crime bills was something called substantial assistance. So basically, your only way out, and the prosecutor would tell you this if he got you into the DEA would tell you this, your only way out, you're going to get a life sentence. Your only way out is to tell on someone else. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you don't know anything about anyone else, or maybe you don't want to be a snitch. So what a lot of people ended up doing is, well, I hear they're really interested in this person. Let me find out some information about that person, and then I'm going to agree to testify against them. And if you think about it, drug cases are the easiest cases to commit perjury. It really created an epidemic of perjury in federal court, because a murder case, you have to know some specific facts to testify against somebody. But these federal drug cases, first of all, there's a 5-year statute of limitations. So generally, by the time they charge it, they're charging conduct that occurred 4 or 5 years ago at the earliest, and some of it going way back to a decade. So you could say, yeah, I was buying my drugs from John, in the summer of 2020. I'd meet him, if I know your address, I'd meet him outside his house, or I'd meet him at the Starbucks or in the parking lot of the Walmart. We'd do our exchanges. Like, how are you going to fight that? There's really no way to disprove that unless you can show you were like on the space shuttle during that time and that you weren't even, around. So it's very easy to lie in drug cases. I have had cases where we were able to prove perjury. There was one case where my client was, they were trying, he was basically friends with a major drug dealer, and they had put him as number two on the 12-person indictment because there was video of him in the company of this drug dealer. And so they wanted to prove, and he didn't want to cooperate. So they wanted to prove that he was a big shot drug dealer. And they would have these guys, like one guy that was maybe bagging for the big shot drug dealer, and he was cooperating. And they kept asking about my client. I'll call him Brian. What did you see Brian doing? And he didn't remember Brian being there. But you hear that enough, and he starts to understand, okay, they really want something on Brian. Oh, Brian was, he was bagging drugs. He was cooking crack. He was talking about who owed what, who owed this money, how we're going to collect. Now, it turned out that the whole time that this was happening, it happened in a particular apartment, this drug dealer's apartment. The whole time this drug dealer had that apartment, my client was locked up in county jail, awaiting trial on a state case. So the prosecutor just misread his rap sheet and thought he was out on bond, but he was actually locked up. So, and you know, the prosecutor still kept on with the case and tried to make an argument that I was just harassing their witness, and he was confused about dates. But the judge, to her credit, said, no, this is false. You're putting on false testimony, and the charges were dismissed. So occasionally you do have wins like that, but it really is tragic. And, you know, the typical federal case is they'll maybe spend a year investigating. There's video surveillance, there's controlled buys from certain people. And then maybe they'll sweep up 15 people. A lot of times it's focused on a housing project or public housing. It's almost always black and brown people, in my experience, that were prosecuted in federal court. Most of the defendants are too poor to hire their own lawyer. So I did some appointed cases, some of these. And then there was never any attempt to go up the chain and find like the big drug importer, which is something that I think people were surprised about, because I think most people think, well, the federal government, if they're going to get involved in drug cases, it's going to be after, you know, Pablo Escobar. But that's not actually the case.
That is not the case.
And, you know, I had the same experience representing people in mortgage fraud cases, because, you know, they didn't prosecute any high level bankers, but they went after people that filled out loan applications and were urged by the loan officer to, you know, to get the ratios right. And, you know, you got to say you earn this much money. And those are the people that were prosecuted and sent to prison. So, yeah, it's and I think the other thing to say about the war on drugs is it was a total failure.
Yeah.
They spent, I don't know, $50 billion a year. The prison population increased in about 20 years tenfold. So we had about 500,000 people in prison in this country in 1980. And by 2000, we had about 2.5 million. The murders went up. Drug abuse problems got worse, addiction overdose got worse. So nothing got better. Families were destroyed. I mean, a whole generation of young people, kids grew up without fathers, or had to visit them in federal prisons. You know, it really was quite tragic. And then I think the other thing that when you do a little research on these sort of policies, we knew back in Prohibition that this strategy didn't work. And I think you mentioned this earlier. This is really attacking the supply. That's the strategy. Yeah. We're going to attack the supply, and then drugs will be scarce, and people won't be able to afford them anymore. It doesn't work. They tried it in Prohibition. And basically what happened in Prohibition is it worked for a little bit, but because beer and wine were hard to transport. But then people found out, okay, well, I can make moonshine, or I'll buy liquor, which is easier to get. So it didn't change the addiction problems. And then it spiked the murder rate, because you have this huge black market, because the prohibition increases, it attracts people into the drug trade. So, you know, so if you think about it, like, so we're blow up boats in out on the coast of Venezuela. Like the thing is, okay, we're gonna like make it harder to get cocaine to the United States. Well, most of the cocaine doesn't come from Venezuela anyway. But even if it did, you know, what you're doing is you're making it more profitable if you drive the price up, you increase the profit. So now people, if a kilo of cocaine is $1,000 in Peru, and $25,000 on the streets of Chicago, people are going to take that risk to bring it in. And maybe they won't come through off the coast of Venezuela. They'll come somewhere else. The other thing is people start using more dangerous drugs if there is a scarcity. And that's what we saw during Prohibition, like the white lightning, where people were dying from drinking this stuff that wasn't safe. And that's another, you know, we've seen that with the war on drugs too, because you have, you know, first it was meth, which is something you don't have to grow in Peru or Colombia. You can make it from industrial chemicals here in the United States. It's incredibly dangerous. And now it's fentanyl.
Yes. You know?
So if there's a scarcity of heroin, people are going to put some fentanyl in there. And of course, we've seen what the results of that is. So all that, I think the one other thing that I would just mention really quick is, we knew all this back in Prohibition. We knew this didn't work. At the end of Prohibition, I think it was 1933, was it Hoover that was president then? I can't remember.
March of 33 is when FDR took the oath of office, but it was okay. Hoover up until March of 33.
Yeah. I think it was Hoover that commissioned this. So they basically did something that's called the Wickersham Commission. And that's like, let's figure out how we can save Prohibition, because there was nothing was working. Murder rate, you know, the Tommy gun,
yes,
murders, the drunkenness, the alcoholism problem was worse.
The mafia took off because right. They were the ones that controlled the illicit liquor trade.
That's right. So organized crime spiked. And so they formed this commission. It was called the Wickersham Commission. And the result was, this is a dismal family. Failure. It cannot be fixed. And that's what led to the repeal of Prohibition. And I think what our government learned from that lesson is, don't study anything. Because if it's not working, we don't really want to know that. Because if the policy is you know, favorable to us or to our donors, we're going to keep it going. And so that's why we've seen this just year after year after year, dismal failure. So
I want to ask you about the role that guns play in some of these cases. And the reason I bring this up is very specific. When I was in prison, I befriended a guy from North Texas named Clint Goswick. Shout out to Clint Goswick. He's an awesome, great human being. Clint had nothing to do with drugs, but he went through a divorce, sort of had this midlife crisis situation going on, was attracted to this young woman that he was working with. They started dating. It turned out that she was involved with drugs. She had Clint throw a big party, and in the garage of his home, there were people smoking meth. It turned out that one of the people in the garage also just happened to have a handgun on him. And somebody reported the party. The cops raided the party. They find drugs. They find alcohol. They find the guy with the gun. Everybody gets arrested, including Clint. After all, it's his house. He told me, and I believe him, he had no idea people were smoking meth in his garage. He was inside the house entertaining other friends. Like you said, they offered him a deal. Where'd the meth come from? Who's the meth boss? Who's controlling the meth trade in this town in North Texas? He didn't know the answer to any of those things. So he couldn't rat anybody out, nor would he have likely been inclined to rat anybody out. He got 17 years in prison, first time, nonviolent offense, mostly because the guy in the garage had a gun in his pocket. And Clint is a very, very pious Christian. And he used to tell me all the time, God's going to take care of me. I'm not going to be in here for much longer. God's going to take care of me. I've asked Jesus, you know, and I used to think, oh, God bless Clint. I wish you the best, buddy. Much to my utter shock, he got out. It was part of that Clinton, you know, he was able to finally successfully argue that, yes, there was a gun in the case. It was not his gun. He never touched a gun. He never saw the gun. He wasn't carrying the gun. And so they commuted his sentence and let him out. And now he's a successful businessman. But you know even better than I do that if there's a gun involved, even peripherally in a case, the cops, especially the feds, are going to seek the longest possible sentence. So it's no wonder that we have people serving decades in prison for first-time nonviolent drug offenses. The sentencing for drug offenses is draconian, and then you throw a gun in with it, forget it. You'll never see the light of day. I'll add one other thing. My very best friend in prison, who has remained one of my best friends in the world, Mark Lanzalotti, one of the finest human beings I've ever known in my life. His stepfather approached him one time. This is about 25 years ago. Stepfather approached him and said, hey, we're going to cook a little bit of meth. You want in? If I can make a couple dollars. They started making meth. he decided it wasn't for him. And of the 9 people involved in the case, Mark was the only one who voluntarily left the conspiracy. 4 years pass. Mark opens a business that is successful, and somebody rats them all out. So they wrap up the 8 guys. Mark said he was just waiting for the anvil to fall on his head. And sure enough, as soon as the statute of limitations began to approach, DEA raided his business and they grabbed him. Okay. Immediately, they started saying to him, you've got to rat everybody out. You've got to rat everybody out. And his stepfather said, I'll pay for your attorney, but not if you rat, because I don't pay for rats. Mark didn't rat anybody out. He had no idea that he was the only one who was not ratting. So all of the 8 co-conspirators got 5 years and 4 months in prison. Mark, who was the only one to leave the conspiracy voluntarily, triple life without parole.
Yeah.
He appealed the sentence and it was reduced to 30 years. I met him when he had been in for 17 years. And finally, just before I left prison, I was hanging out in his cell. I was reading the New York Times about the, what was it called? The First Step Act or the Second Chance Act or whatever it was. And I'm reading it and I said, buddy, did you read this article? And he said, no. I said, they're talking about you in this article. First time nonviolent drug offense with no connection to organized crime.
Yeah.
And he said, yeah, but I don't have money for an attorney. I said, how hard could it be? So I wrote an appeal. And then I got out a couple of weeks later. His mother called me, April, May, June, July, August. His mother calls me 6 months later and says, you're not going to believe this, but the Justice Department has accepted your appeal for Mark, and they've assigned it to this A-list firm in Washington. And 2 months later, he was home. But he got lucky. Yeah. Most people don't get lucky like that. So tell us a little bit about the role of guns and these draconian sentences if you don't rat out your co-conspirators.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, first of all, congratulations on your career as a jailhouse lawyer.
I know, right? And I could have gotten in serious trouble for doing, you know, legal work.
Oh, yeah. I don't think so.
To solitary for that.
No. Well, yeah, I'm not aware of that, but you're right about guns. I mean, guns is, it's another sort of social control mechanism. But I mean, technically, you know, a drug, if there's a drug that's associated with the, I'm sorry, if there's a gun that's associated with a drug transaction, that is like a 5-year enhancement. But there's supposed to be some evidence to connect the drug to the drug transaction. And then, of course, there has to be evidence connecting to the gun to the person that they're charging. So, yeah, but of course it's loosey goosey in federal court. And if you don't have the right lawyer, you know,
forget it.
They're gonna, and there's a lot of lawyers. You talked about, you know, this, the stepfather who said, I'm not going to pay for a lawyer if you're going to be a snitch. And I know lawyers like that. And I pretty much help. It's not possible to do it all the time, but I basically didn't represent cooperators knowingly. Sometimes I get appointed on a case. And I know other lawyers as well. But then there's other lawyers that in the system that only represent cooperators, and they basically tell everyone to cooperate. And sometimes they'll appoint those lawyers, because I had a case, you know, I had a case where I had a client. He was from Chicago, but he was living in a small town in Iowa called Clinton, Iowa. And he was running. He was a
Clinton, Iowa. I've been to Clinton, Iowa.
Yeah, it's on the Mississippi. It's a nice little town. But but they basically had gone after the black community in that town. This was mid-90s, and put a lot of people away for life for drug dealing. And a lot of the white drug dealers in town were given immunity to testify against these guys. So, but my client, he ran like a social club there, and the DEA was really interested in him because there were a lot of black people that hung out at his club. So they figured he knew everything that was going on, even though all the people that they would interview about him said, nah, he's not really involved. He doesn't have any money. He doesn't have two nickels to rub together. This guy wears the same clothes every day. But they figured he knew something. So they went after him and he refused to cooperate. And then they just brought in all these people from prison that are doing now 20 to life and said, what do you know about Yuka? What do you know about Yuka? And next thing you know, they make a case against him. Oh, yeah, I bought drugs from him back that summer, and I did this, and I saw him do that. One woman who worked for him at this club, she had moved out of Clinton. She was in Minnesota with her seven kids, single mom. They went up there. They had already interviewed her when she was living in town. She said, no, I never saw him with drugs. He wasn't really involved. He wasn't into that. They went up there. I think they were afraid she was going to be a defense witness for me. So they went up there. They grabbed her. They had a grand jury subpoena. They put her kids in daycare in Minnesota and brought her down to Clinton. It was actually Davenport was where the case was tried. And they told her, you're not going home until you tell us what you know about Yuka. It's drug dealing. And eventually, after about 12 hours, she said what they wanted and they sent her back home. So yeah, it's a horrible, horrible system, and it solved nothing. It went on for so long. You know, I think, you know, part of it is just the federal government. They don't really answer to the people. You know, they don't care if a policy doesn't work as long as the donors are okay with it. And, you know, so we see now there's some good news. Well, first of all, you mentioned the First Step Act, which I think that was Trump.
Then it was the Second Chance Act.
Well, the Second
Chance. It was the one under Obama.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. There were a bunch of clemencies under Obama. But Trump also passed a law that was quite significant.
It
did help a lot of people.
Very forward looking.
Yeah. So, you know, there was some hope. But, yeah, now it does seem like he's trying to reignite the war on drugs by blowing up boats outside of Venezuela. I don't know anyone that believes that this is about drugs. And maybe there are some people. Apparently there are people that believe it and think, yeah, we're getting the, you know, the cartel members. But I don't know anyone that believes it. And I don't know. So it's – We'll see what the future is, but let's hope we don't have another.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
The one other thing that maybe we could talk about for a second is, you know, the marijuana, because.
Let's do that. Yes.
Yeah. You know, that is, I think it's a real good example. So basically what happened is Trump reclassified it from category one to category three. So category one is no medical use substance, like methamphetamine, heroin. That's what it's been for the last, 30, 40 years, marijuana. And, you know, even as most people understand, the states now are saying enough. We're not going to put people in prison for marijuana. We're going to, it's stupid.
It is.
But the thing about the states is they actually have to balance their budgets. So if a policy isn't working, at some point they have to fix it. The state lawmakers, the governor, the mayors of cities, they can't really keep these programs going and just fill the jails with people because they can't afford it. The feds don't care about that because they don't, They run deficits. They can write bad checks. They don't really care about balancing a budget. They don't care if a policy is working. I think that's why there's so much insanity in the federal government. So it took, 40 years to just reclassify marijuana and admit that, yeah, okay, maybe it has some medical use. So I don't know what the effect of this is going to be. It's still criminal. But, you know, they were raiding dispensaries.
Oh, yeah.
The DEA was raiding dispensaries, like, fairly recently. Mm-hmm. And
dispensaries can't deposit any of their money. It's
right.
Cash. Everything has to be in cash. You can't put it in a bank. You end up just sitting on pallets of cash. And what do? You have to launder it, if anything.
Right. Because the banks are federally insured. Mm-hmm. So the feds won't allow it. And So we'll see if that changes now with this reclassification. I don't know.
But, I wonder. So. I have to read an ad from our sponsor. Okay. We're very proud to be sponsored by American Alternative Assets. Well, three billionaires, four major banks, one respected economist, all pointing to the same thing. That is a historic move in gold that appears to be coming. Goldman Sachs says gold could surge 20% more than it already has. JP Morgan is saying 25%. Ray Dalio, Jeffrey Gundlach, and even a legendary 72-year-old investor are calling for gold now between $10,000 and $12,000 an ounce. But here's what they're not saying publicly. One economist believes the U.S. government will deliberately raise gold's official price to deal with the debt crisis. Not speculation, not a guess. This would be a policy decision, and almost no one is talking about it. American Alternative Assets just released a free report that breaks it all down. It's called The Surprising Case for $10,000 Gold. Call 888-GOLD-053 or, and this is easy, visit johnlovesgold.com to get a free copy. That's 888-GOLD-053 or johnlovesgold.com. By the time this story hits the headlines, the real opportunity will be gone. Don't wait. We're speaking with my friend Len Goodman, a prominent attorney in the Midwest, really nationwide, and not one who I always thought just focused on civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, but also this ridiculous and destructive war on drugs. You know, I've said in various podcasts, I'm a creature of habit, Len, like most of us are when we get a little older. And every day I DVR two episodes of Dragnet from the late 60s and two episodes of Adam 12 from the early 70s. I love them. I'm addicted to them. I've seen every episode 150 times. But one thing that always makes me laugh is Jack Webb's obsession with marijuana. Granted, we're talking about 1967, 1968, but he always does this thing. And he wrote most of the scripts himself, so I know it's him. But he does this thing where he'll go up to someone and say, you know, we caught your daughter with marijuana. And the parent will say, narcotics? And then he responds, dangerous drugs. So marijuana is not a narcotic, nor is it dangerous. And then there was one scene in an episode recently, which was supposed to be outrageous. It was meant to be outrageous and ridiculous, where a hippie is saying, you know, when the hippies become adults, they're going to change the marijuana laws. And Jack Webb says, not likely, fella. Well, here we are in 2025, and people are finally coming to their senses that, first of all, it's unless you're smoking it constantly, lighting one joint off the other and getting this new, whatever they're calling it, the psychosis, marijuana psychosis or whatever it's called, cannabis psychosis. It's helpful mentally, physically, people who have cancer, people who have glaucoma, people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. There are a lot of good things coming out of marijuana. In many places around the country, in most states across the country, it's already legal at the state level. So then my question is, let's say it continues to be legalized at the state level, which is what the trend is, but the government doesn't move off this Category 3 now. Now, Category 3 is pretty progressive. Kudos to Donald Trump for doing this today.
Yeah.
So it's pretty progressive, but it's still a federal crime. So what happens next? Is the Justice Department actually going to be prosecuting people for likely not just for having a joint, smoking some weed, or maybe having a little bag in his pocket or whatever? But I was in prison with people doing decades for having marijuana in the trunk of the car and driving from point A to point B.
Yep.
Do you think that's going to change?
Well, you know, basically, we're, you know, as you mentioned, we're sort of if you're in the business of a dispensary, that's a risk that you're going to have to take, because you don't know if the policy is going to change. Right now, it doesn't seem like they're being aggressive at going after that. But we, you know, your business is survives at the goodwill of the federal government because they can shut you down. And, you know, the whole thing, you know, really, if you look at you know, our founding fathers didn't want to have a federal police force. This was not something that was part of the Constitution. It's very limited, the federal jurisdiction. It's, you know, treason cases, it's counterfeiting currency. I guess bank robbery is a legitimate federal crime because they insure the banks, and they're pretty good at that, bank robberies. I've represented a lot of bank robbers. The feds generally do a good job on those cases. But drugs, there's really no reason for the federal government to be in the business of drugs. It's pure politics. It's just to whatever, you know, to pretend that they're doing something that's helpful, or maybe it's helping the donors. I mean, there's been people that speculate that the obsession with drugs is to protect people in big pharma that don't want you to be able to grow your own drugs or your marijuana. You know, I grew up listening to Cheech and Chong. So right. You know,
Up in Smoke.
You know, when you were reading that commercial, I was thinking about one of my favorite bits. It was Acapulco Gold Filters, where Chong keeps blowing the take because he wants another joint and to keep smoking. So yeah, those are very funny. I recommend, I know most, I actually taught, I teach as an adjunct at DePaul, but I used to teach college law. And I would bring in sometimes some of my old Cheech and Chong records for these kids. Like there's one where he's in court with his lawyer, you know, in a drug case. They all thought I was crazy because it's like nobody listens to comedy records anymore.
But, no, I used to buy every time a good comedy record came out, I would buy it every single time.
Me too.
And they make the joke. Like, who was it? Was it George Carlin that made the joke? No. It was what was his name? The African-American guy that freebased and set himself
Richard
on
Pryor.
Richard Pryor. Sorry. Yeah. Richard Pryor saying you get arrested, you go to the courthouse looking for justice. And that's what you find. Just us.
Right. Justice Department. That's what we have. Yeah. Well,
yeah. So with this trend taking place, and I'll add under a Republican president, do you think we're going to get to the point where marijuana is legalized and taxed like alcohol is, and that people will be allowed to buy it on a credit card, and dispensary owners will be allowed to deposit their revenue in banks? Are we headed in that direction?
I mean, I think so. I feel like we're not going to be able to go back. I think there's the public is too accustomed now. I don't know. I have to say, I never thought I would see the day as an American, when you could walk into a store in a civilized, you know, you didn't have to meet your guy in the parking lot of the whatever to buy a bag of weed, you know? So I don't think people want to go back to that. And, you know, at some point the federal government has, you know, they still have to get elected. So I think, you know, at some point they do have to respond to the will of the voters. So I'm going to say no. I'm not a very good predictor. I'm usually wrong when I make a prediction, but yeah, I'm going to say that we will get there. And I think, you know, I guess this is a good step for Trump. I'd like to see him decriminalize marijuana because it's serving no purpose.
So let's say that happens. Yeah. And I agree with you. I think because of the trend that we've seen, there's no going back. It's going to happen. It may take a little while, but it's going to happen. But what does it mean? What does it mean for prison sentences related to other drugs? Now we've got this national situation with fentanyl, where for three consecutive years, the average lifespan of an American actually decreased because so many people are overdosing on fentanyl. My ex-brother-in-law overdosed and died on wow. fentanyl. Yeah, it was a shock, 35 years old. But he did it once too many times.
Or he probably wasn't intending to take
No. His dealer was arrested and said that he sold him an Oxy tablet, which was, you know, manufactured with fentanyl. And so I mean, millions of families are affected all across America. Do you see any kind of a tie or a connection between easing up on marijuana sentencing laws and marijuana control laws versus harder drugs? Or is this, I'm going to use the word, war on fentanyl, reminiscent of what we saw in the 80s with cocaine?
Well, I mean, drugs like fentanyl are products of prohibition. You know, to me, you decriminalize. That doesn't mean that a kid can walk into Walgreens and buy fentanyl or buy heroin. You regulate it and you spend the money that we're now spending on destroying families and locking up, their fathers and mothers. You spend that money on education, on drug treatment, like you mentioned. And drugs like fentanyl are really, they're a product. So it's, you know, it's very potent. A lot of times these drugs, these overdose cases, it's not even that some dealer intended to put the fentanyl in there. It's that there was fentanyl, whatever, when he was mixing or making his pills, because it's not regulated. It's amateurish, people with their own pill presses and, you know, that some fentanyl got into the drugs without even knowing it. And it's so potent. And if somebody, you know, like your relative doesn't have a tolerance for it, they're goners. You know, I have a really close friend that almost died the same way. And he thought he was snorting cocaine and he ended up, his heart stopped. And, you know, fortunately the paramedic saved him. But
in LA, the comedian Andy Dick was in Hollywood with a group of friends. A homeless man recognized him, remembered that Andy Dick has been very public about his love of crack cocaine, and said, "Hey, Andy Dick, I have some crack. You want to smoke?" He said, "Sure." So they go behind a building. He takes a couple of hits of the crack pipe and he's dead because it was fentanyl. Thank goodness one of his friends wandered back there to see where'd Andy go, realized what was happening and was able to get him, what's it called? Narcan. Yeah. And he popped right back up again, but he was clinically dead for a few seconds. And then said, you know, stupid. He said, "I do love crack. And the guy offered me crack. And I should have thought, I don't know this homeless guy. There could be fentanyl in it." And there was. And it almost killed him.
Yeah. So it's just an insane system. I mean, you know, if we really cared about people and addiction, there's a lot smarter way.
That's right.
To regulate drugs. And if people are going to use, you know, it should be done safely. And we should, when they're ready to get off drugs, there should be resources available to help them, instead of just this, you know, lock them up, throw away the key policy, right, which clearly is not working.
No, it's not working. Len, do you see any leaders on Capitol Hill that you can point to as someone who might be willing to take up this issue or someone who has taken on a leadership role on this issue?
I mean, that's a really good question. I haven't been in that world for a while. You know, there's some really good organizations. There's Families Against Mandatory Minimums.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Sure, they would know.
They're wonderful.
You know, who they're working with currently. But I just don't know who's been out there on this issue and who's had the courage. You know, it's sad because, you know, in the old days, there were, you know, judges, you know, during the heyday of the war on drugs, it's like the Fourth Amendment was rewritten. And there was a joke that there's a drug exception to the Fourth Amendment now. It's unwritten rule because a lot of judges were afraid to throw out a big drug case. There was one when Clinton was running for president. I don't know if you remember this, and I'll get it wrong, but it was somebody that was stopped in Manhattan with like a whole trunk full of cocaine and heroin or something like that. But the police didn't have probable cause to stop him. So the case went to federal court. His lawyer filed a motion to dismiss or to suppress the evidence under the Fourth Amendment. And the judge granted it. And it became like a criticism of Clinton, because I think the judge was appointed by Clinton.
And
that he's appointing these liberal judges who are going to poison Manhattan with all these drugs. Of course, they don't give him his drugs back when the case was suppressed. But Clinton, to his great disgrace, pressured that judge to change the decision.
The judge
did. He reconsidered, and then they put this guy away. So, people need to have the courage to do the right thing. And, you know, I think you've had that experience. Not many people do have that courage. You know, I don't understand that, because judges have a lifetime appointment.
Right.
And they could say F you to President Clinton. You know, this is the law. There's the fourth. I took an oath to follow the Constitution, not some political figure. So there's nothing they can do to him. I mean, you can be impeached, but that's only for good cause or for malfeasance. I wish more judges had the courage to stand up and do the right thing.
I agree. I remember on the day of my sentencing, because my case was a high profile case and there were so many members of the media there, the judge sentenced me last. And, literally everybody that went before me for sentencing, and it had to be, I'm going to say it was probably 20 people. Every one of them was a drug case. And many of them were drug cases against undocumented immigrants.
And what year was this?
This was January of 2013.
Okay.
January 2013 in the Eastern District of Virginia, Judge Leonie Brinkema, who was a Clinton appointee, but a hanging judge. And as she pronounced sentence on each one of these people, and for most of them, it was 10 years, 20 years, followed by deportation, she would say that she had considered the sentence and that the sentence was fair and appropriate. And in the meantime, I had never seen anything like this before in my life. I've never been in a federal sentencing before. There were little kids sobbing, women sobbing, the kids grabbing onto their father's pant legs, and then the father's being led away in shackles. And it was like, what kind of society do we live in? And then she's looking down from her bench, all 4 feet, 10 inches over, and she's looking down and saying, the sentence is well considered. It is fair and appropriate. And then she hits her gavel.
Yeah.
It has stuck in my mind all these years as is like one of the sickest things that I've ever been forced to watch.
You know, I should say also, because there are federal judges in my experience in doing drug cases who didn't want to be part of this system that you're talking about. And that did stand up and that did refuse to go along. A lot of times they were reassigned or something, but
yeah.
there were judges that I know some that just refused to take any more criminal cases. I'm just not going to be part of this.
Wow.
It's so yeah, but really it. I don't know. I just think it's a problem with the federal system. You know, they just. They work for the donors, and it's true of every agency. You know, the FBI, and you see this again and again in federal practice. And I think that's why there's, you know, so much burnout. You just like, don't really want to be part of it anymore. But, you know, I think I mentioned the mortgage fraud. That to me, that was even in some ways more shocking, because, you know, they had made a conscious decision not to go after the bankers, the Wall Street guys. And they were the ones that gamed the whole system, you know, these mortgages. And but they still had to prove that they really cared about, because the stock market crashed and the economy almost destroyed the economy. So they had to prove that they were going to do something about it. And so what are they going to do? They're going to lock up some peons, people that filled out loan applications, and they're going to put them in prison. It was really shameful. The prosecutors that participated in that should be ashamed of themselves. And I would say the same about these drug cases, you know, to take some father away from his family for 20 years or for life. I had a client that got life. We ended up getting him out years later on a habeas, really by luck. But that's the case in Davenport, Iowa. And it shook me to the core. I mean, I think part of it was I was a Chicago lawyer coming in there. And so I think I was, you know, they didn't really have much.
You were the big gun.
Yeah, I was just, you know, the big city lawyer in coming to Davenport. And I was very young and naive, and I fought like crazy for my client. And, you know, but we went to trial and they called. I think they set a record for the number of informants they called against him. I mean, people he didn't even know were testifying against him. And yeah, I saw him because they all wanted a deal and they all wanted to get out of prison and they were all doing time themselves. So, yeah, it was shocking to me. And that was the case where they brought in the mom, and put her kids in daycare and forced her to tell lies about him. So, yeah. And that judge was perfectly comfortable giving him a life sentence, had no qualms about it at all. And this client, he's still a good friend of mine. I talk to him all the time. He's here in Chicago. So
there's a man that I referred to you who received a terrible, terrible sentence of something like 70 years only because he wouldn't cooperate.
Right. That's right.
It happens more often than most Americans realize. And lives are ruined. Families are wrecked, never to be reconstructed again. Some system we've given ourselves.
Yeah, it's a very coercive system. And I, you know, hopefully people will never have to experience the federal system, but it is a very oppressive and it's very arbitrary. And I think that's the way they like it. And, you know, a lot of these laws where they basically pass these mandatory sentences and then say the only way you can get out is to cooperate with the prosecutor. Really what that does is it takes the discretion away from a judge who maybe would have a tendency to be fair, but it gives that discretion to the prosecutor. Because the prosecutor is now going to decide, okay, you don't want to talk to me? You're going to get the life sentence. Somebody's going to get a life sentence here, you know? And that just isn't justice. And we shouldn't allow that type of system, but, you know.
Say that again.
Yeah.
I have one last question for you. Donald Trump really shook up the Justice Department back in March when he named Joshua Smith, a former drug felon who served 5 years in federal prison, as the deputy director of the Bureau of Prisons. I thought this was one of the most wonderful moves I've seen from any president in my lifetime. I thought it was incredibly insightful and progressive. Who better knows the problems of the federal prison system than a federal prisoner?
Yeah.
Especially one who has half a brain.
Yeah.
The funny thing to me was the initial reaction, at least from the prison guards union, was that they will never answer to a felon, a convict, one of them called him. And actually, yeah, they do. He's fit in well. He's trying to make some changes in the BOP. What do you think about this appointment? And do you think that it's possible to change the Bureau of Prisons that way, or is the place in such need of change that change has to come from Congress?
Well, I mean, like you say, who knows better what works and what doesn't work and what needs to be done in federal prison than a former prisoner? I remember there was this was also out of New York. I went to Columbia University, so I think this was around the time I was in college. But yeah, there was a judge who went to prison. He was sort of a lock him up judge. He went to prison. I don't remember what it was for, but he came out and he had a whole new man. He had a different understanding of the system, and he was a great judge after that. He went back on the bench. So I applaud Trump for that as well. And, you know, I think we need, you know, I mean, to have people that are just like, you know, these lock him up, people that have no real experience with the justice system. I mean, the other thing is if you have a family member that's gone through it, that changes the way you see the system.
That's right.
Obviously, if you yourself go through it. So That's That experience is really valuable, and we should have leaders that have different experience. And, you know, one other thing I'll say, and I know you probably want to wrap up, but, you know, most judges are former prosecutors.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That's a serious beef that I have with the system. You're exactly right. Most judges are former prosecutors.
Yeah. So I just would encourage, you know, our senators and presidents to look for some people that have more varied experience, you know, in their legal careers when they're appointing judges. Because most defense lawyers think, I have no chance of being a, you know, no one's going to appoint me as a federal judge.
Right.
I think I agree with you that people with different backgrounds is very important for the justice system.
I agree. Len, where can people learn more about your work?
Yeah, I do have a website, leonardgoodman.com. And that's just my writing. I've been a columnist for a while. I got canceled during COVID because I wrote a column about my reasons for not vaccinating my child. And I had protesters outside of my house. I'm a big free speech guy. I also am part of a foundation called Integrity Media, which I think you're aware of.
And they're wonderful.
That we try to support people in independent media. I also have a podcast called Unfettered Speech, John has been a guest on. So
fun conversation.
Find me at all those places. And if you need a good lawyer, and if you get trouble in Chicago or in federal court, you can call me.
Amen. I would all second right. that. Yes. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.